Good morning, everyone. We're going to get started with our board meeting for today. The first topic up is leasing. Good morning to the blue team in Norwalk. We're going to try and promise you a blue sky kind of day today. And with that, let me hand over to Nick to lead us through the first paper.
Thanks, Leslie. We're going to go a little bit out of order this morning. We're going to discuss presentation and disclosure for leases. We're going to start with the statement of cash flow paper. That would be ISB agenda reference 5B and FASB agenda reference 188. And then we're going to move on to 190. We had a FASB education session on these issues, and a lot of the discussion revolved around these two papers, so we thought we'd kick off with these first. The majority of the changes in all of these memos stem from two places. One, the comment letters and all the outreach that we did drive some of the changes that we're proposing from what is required by the ED. And the other changes really are a result of any of the changes in the underlying recognition and measurement decisions that have been made to date, and that's driven some of these changes as well. So that said, in paper 188, ISB agenda reference 5B, there's four issues about the statement of cash flow to discuss. The first is the presentation of interest. Second, classification of variable lease payments, not included in the liability to make lease payments. Supplemental cash flow disclosure of the ROU assets added, and cash flows associated with payments on short-term leases. So, on the first issue, presentation of interest, a number of the comment letters pointed out that interest in U.S. GAAP is not included in the financing section of the cash flow statement, whereas under IAS 7, it could be in financing, it could be in operating, it could be embedded in net income. There's variance between the two sets of requirements, and so the staff is recommending that we revise the ED to state that the cash paid for principal portion of the lease be financing and the interest portion be classified or disclosed in accordance with the applicable cash flow guidance. Do the boards agree?
Okay. Comments? Stephen?
I don't disagree, but how does one identify the interest and principal component of a lease payment in other than sort of a straight line situation?
In other than?
Well, if you have a 2-year rent-free period and then you have lease payments thereafter, is it possible to unequivocally identify the principal and interest?
I would think the payments that you're making are for the interest and the remainder would be for the principal. Possibly.
It was just the straight
Steve
line,
is,
right?
Yeah, I mean, straight line, right?
Is your point that other than using the accounting distinction?
Yes.
Right.
You have to pick up the number from the income statement.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's what you're thinking of. That's what people do, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay.
My point was that's what came over Ed's session. I was going
to
ask.
Oh, okay. And Pat?
When I read this paper, my first reaction was a lot of it makes sense. But then when I sat back, I said, you're recommending three different ways on how to classify interest and principal payments. And that's where I kind of got off, with the recommendation. For example, cash paid for variable lease payments is excluded from the determination of liability to make lease payments. Should be classified within operating cash flows. Obviously, there's a component of interest and principal in a variable lease payment. Question was, how are you going to deal with that? But as I said, you're recommending three different approaches here, variable lease payments, short-term lease payments, and I guess the regular minimum non-cancelable. And I just think from an understandability standpoint, it's easier rather than have purity natural classification, it might be easier just to go with one approach so people know where to go and where to find it. But
yeah, it's the constraint of the cash flow statement where the items that are running through net income in the current period are typically in operating.
Mm-hmm.
And so the decisions we've made, and this is for variable lease payments such as contingent rentals, that those would come through in the period as a period cost and not be included in the liability to make lease payments, and so to then put them into financing as a settlement of the liability that they're not included in was what drove that particular recommendation. If you do put them in financing, what you're going to have, and we illustrate this in Appendix B to Paper 190, and it's paragraph, it's following paragraph 5. What happens when you do include the variable lease payments or the interest payments down in financing is you have a bunch of adjustments that have to happen in operating. You have to, so you'll have it in both places, like an in and an out. And so if that's the decision to go in that direction, that's just going to be the consequence from a – it's a really mechanical accounting-y issue, but that's what's going to happen. So just as long as – everybody's aware there's going to be more adjustments in the operating section of the cash flow statement that's prepared on an indirect basis.
Okay. Russ?
I agree with a lot of what Pat Finnegan was saying. I thought that your recommendations flowed well in relation to the other decisions in the statement of cash flows. But that said, I was uncomfortable with differentiating between basically fixed payments and variable payments and putting some in operating and some in financing. So I think those ought to all be put in the same place in the statement of cash flows, and I suppose financing is the right place.
With everything?
No.
That's how we're treating.
We're treating it as a liability. I agree with liability. I disagree with financing the income statement, but it would seem strange as financing for income statement, financing for balance sheet, and operating for statement of cash flow. But with respect to interest, I am concerned about putting interest within financing, at least from a U.S. GAAP perspective, that's inconsistent with how we treat other financing. And so, Pat, I think you were saying maybe interest should go with the other payments, but I would be concerned that now we'd basically have an exception just for leasing activities and being consistent with how we do other financing activities.
Darryl?
I can see the justification for the classification that we've used, but I can also see the benefit of having it all together. I guess my question would be, if we're providing these statements for the benefit of users, do we have any idea how users would prefer it?
Some of the users that we spoke with, I think at the ITAC meeting, said that we've thought about this in the right way, although they've raised the exact same issues. You know, that's not how we do this with debt, but to have it in one place would work. I think that... And again, this might bring in some of the outreach that we had in FSP on cash flow statements, is all the articulation changes that you need to make from net income to get down to an operating number, adding to that is not necessarily going to be useful. We're going to add two or three more lines or two or three more adjustments that might be embedded in other lines in the operating section to make it even more confusing.
To pull it out of there and put it somewhere else.
So I don't know that that's a desirable result from a user perspective. The other thing is we'll get into the discussions about the roll forwards. And so a lot of what we've heard also is if I have some of that information synthesized there, that'll be useful. So,
okay.
Thanks.
Okay. Larry?
I guess my initial reaction, I erased it this morning, the marks, was next to your recommendation I said inconsistency seems hard to swallow. But then listening to your tee up, I said, well, you know, that makes sense. Makes sense in my mind only if you have other disclosures which will enable the users to see exactly what the cash payments were for lease payments.
Right.
You know, and if we're planning on requiring that, which I think you have to, and I would just require it as a disclosure so users don't have to add a whole bunch of different numbers, et cetera, then I'm perfectly fine with your recommendation. And, you know, it's consistent with how we do cash flow statements, in my mind. What? Well, you want to redo the cash flow statement? Well, let's add a project.
We have one. Does it strike
you as odd that the way to make it work is to do disclosures, because what goes on the face doesn't seem to logically work? Doesn't that just strike you as odd?
Yes.
Well, you tell me, I mean, the decision as to where to put the variable or contingent payment, doesn't it seem odd that it might not reconcile to the debt number on the balance sheet if you throw it in financing?
So I think
so
we have to get...
Any way you right. do it is going to be odd, and it seems a lot easier to the user if you just disclose the number so that they don't have to hunt and peck for it.
Or you can once step back and consider whether the basic idea was correct.
Well, I mean, to that point, it does seem to be adding insult to injury. If we know that there are strongly held views on both sides of this issue, some people want to see a financing number and some people want to see a cash flow number. This recommendation is saying bifurcate the cash flow number so that users would have to add it back together to get the number they want. It just doesn't pass the... Sorry, I was going to say common sense test, but irrespective of the technicalities, which I think you've done the exact right analysis in the paper, I just think we got to take a step back and look at it. Mark?
So it's on the same vein. I think that I couldn't disagree with any of the individual decisions. I think all the individual decisions that you recommended and you analyzed were right. I think you have to do what Larry said, and you have to disclose the number. I think the users that said they want an operating, want to think about it as operating, want to get the expense lined up with the cash flow, and so you're going to need to give them the cash flow number. And frankly, I want to make a plea, because we do have a project on this. It's called Financial Statement Presentation. And Financial Statement Presentation has this right. Put it all into operating finance.
Oh, right.
Right? And it put it right there, and everybody had it, and it was right. We've got to get that project back going, and because that'll clean it up.
Sorry. Pat?
I was going to say essentially the same thing Mark said. I mean, this highlights why everyone told us they didn't use the cash flow statement, because the cash flow statement isn't very useful. And it's why we need to reopen the financial statement presentation project, at least for the cash flow statement.
Other comments? Does it make sense to take the votes on these one at a time, or do you want to have Nick?
We might be able to. I mean, I think there's the question that you're asking is, should the full payment be in financing? So maybe you might want to ask that question first.
Yes.
Yep. Yeah. I mean,
in other words, don't bifurcate the payment. Well, that or operating, but presumably it would be in financing. Just because
I mean,
the
answer might be no, and then we'd have to take them one at a time. I think. If the answer were no, then we'd kind of have to take these one at a time.
Right? I got you. Yep.
But short-term leases also, we haven't really discussed that. As far as cash flow goes either, so maybe we want to take that one separately.
Okay, let me ask the question the way the staff has worded it, which is, do you think that the lease payment should be allocated or bifurcated between the piece that relates to principal and the piece that relates to interest for purposes of the cash flow statement? Tom, did you have a comment before?
Well, I just wanted to respond to the financing notion, why in financing. I think it's important. You might not like it, but the whole model in the Statement of Financial Position, the Statement of Comprehensive Income, has it as a financing item. It seems that if you start with those two statements and we have any notion of cohesiveness, you keep it in financing in the cash flow statement.
Before you talk about, can you give me an education on the difference between IFRS and U.S. GAAP on this issue about interest and
sure.
debt? Because I'm afraid this is important.
Right. In U.S. GAAP, the number is, if you're doing an indirect cash flow statement, the number is embedded within net income and you disclose interest paid separately. And the reason for that is you can pull that number, you can make the adjustment out of operating and put it in financing. I mean, that's really why it's there. In IFRS, in IAS 7, you can present your interest in operating, you can present it in financing, you can leave it in net income, and break it off to the side and disclose it. So you have, it can be in a couple of different places. So you have a little leeway.
But if most of these leases have been accounted for as operating heretofore, this is a new issue for people.
This is still a new issue. It needs
clarification.
Okay. Yep.
Isn't the whole idea, though, at least from a U.S. GAAP standpoint, that by putting the liability on the balance sheet, we're trying to treat the financing just like any other financing, any other borrowing? And for debt, the principal payments and financing and the interest is in operating. So to me, I was thinking that the staff recommendation made perfect sense and consistent with that. So that's just my way of thinking.
I guess my only point to that would be we received some pretty compelling feedback that investors want to see the cash payments. The disclosure?
Yeah. When we get to this.
Yeah, I know, but okay. Okay, Elka.
I think for me it goes a bit back to looking at the disclosure now tells me I've got a major concern. I'm perfectly fine in spelling out something as being finance, what we called in former times finance lease, but to consider the lease of the copier and the lease of the laptops, a finance, and then have this disclosed and make an additional disclosure to get you back to square one, tells me we have to go back to square one first to consider, do we really believe these are all finance transactions? Well, then I think I'm perfectly fine with your consideration. If not, I think the problem is not the disclosure. The problem is the previous decision.
Larry.
It just seems kind of weird that many, many users have told us that they view these as operating costs, yet the proposal you just put forth is to classify all these as financing. Now, obviously, they can pull it out and reclass it and do the calculation, but it just seems that the proposal is just the opposite of what the users are recommending. That's number one. Number two, if you're going to do it that way, if that's the proposal, just tell me, included in that proposal, I assume, is that this will be separately disclosed on the statement of cash flows. I mean, because otherwise, I don't see how you do it.
The ED says that the cash flows be presented separately. We're not proposing a change to that portion of the ED, so I would think that would stay.
Okay.
But materiality could rein that as well, so you might lose it.
On Larry, on your point about users are saying they want this in operating, I think those might be the same users that don't want an acceleration for interest expense.
Yes.
And so, I mean, we have users in different camps. We have operating users and we have finance users. We've chosen to go down the financing route.
That's fair.
And it seems like you ought to stay on that train. Now, I don't really want to go down the financing route, but you all know that. But I don't think we should go financing for some and operating for others.
Yeah. Pat?
It's not an ideal solution, but there is one other section in the cash flow statement, and that's investing. But seriously, the other side of the entry is to an asset, and some people do view these as capital expenditures because they are your operating assets, and so you might want to consider putting it in investing because they are creating assets. If they were buying these assets and they bought them for cash, it would be an investing. So,
is that right? If they bought the asset,
yes.
Yeah.
Cash payment relating to repaying
PP&E.
The debt?
No.
But if they pay for it with cash out.
Oh, right. Of course. Yeah. Okay. Tom?
Russ made the point. Okay. I don't think we should be splitting these two apart. Users think of them either all think of them in operating or all as financing. Our artificial split doesn't help them either way because everybody's got to be making adjustments then. The point is that do they need to hunt and peck to make the adjustment? And just because we split these apart, they're not necessarily all going to be disclosed in separate line items in the statement. So there is no guidance to say what line items you have to put in the statement all the time. You could aggregate these things, and it's lost.
Okay. Yeah, but the blue shirt doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to agree. Okay, let me start with the basic question of whether people agree with the staff recommendation that there should be an allocation of the cash payment into a principal piece and an interest piece. Who supports the staff recommendation? Oh, okay, sorry, ISB first, please.
Seven?
That's seven. Okay, FASB, who supports the staff recommendation to allocate?
One, two, three, four, five.
We call it a financing. Our whole basis is that you bought something.
You could have put the whole payment in financing, though.
I want variable payments and fixed payments together. I think the interest component, we should be positive.
What the Daryl are just...
Oh, I'm sorry. Next time we'll like this. Say it again, Russ.
my basis was that I think that the whole basis of we're treating this is if they have incurred debt to buy an asset, and the way you account for the repayment of debt and interest is you separate it.
But you wouldn't buy your payments?
What was your... I'm sorry.
I would pay myself not to debt on the balance sheet.
In accordance with the staff recommendation? Because then he would not have voted yes because he wants variable...
There was no variable payments in there.
It was just question one. Do you want to allocate?
Allocation. Okay. Yeah. Fundamental allocation.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
I take the point some would want operating, some would want the financing piece. It seems to me if you keep it together, we're going to be talking about should we split it apart to disclose the other piece that the other guy doesn't get. And so it just seems to be either way, you got the problem Larry's trying to address with this disclosure.
But why, John? Because you've already got the interest piece showing up in interest expense on the income statement.
But it may not.
All other interest.
Sorry?
It may not be.
It may not be separately, yeah.
Which
yeah.
is a disclosure issue.
Stephen.
In terms of the interest and principal, I don't see how we could do anything other than what we do at the moment for finance or capital leases. And there's the flexibility in IFRS, which is because people start the cash flow statement at different points. Some start with operating profits, some start with the net income. So to accommodate that, you have to have the flexibility about where you put the interest on the cash flow statement. And US GAAP is more prescriptive, so I just think we should follow what we do at the moment in respect to finance leases.
Recommendation. Okay. But Mark has the good point.
Okay, so...
We then need to improve it.
Okay, so in the face of that vote, which was five FASB board members supporting the allocation and seven IASB, I'm going to ask, would any IASB board members be willing to change their vote to... require an allocation consistent with current approach. So let's see, ISB supporting the staff recommendation. Okay, so that's 13. Okay, Nick, question two?
Okay, so question two is really around the variable lease payments. We've already had the discussion about whether or not they should be in financing or operating. The one other thing that we do consider in the appendix is how this might impact the roll forward of the liability. When we talk about that decision, if you decide that you do want to roll forward the liability and make lease payments, maybe think about whether or not the variable lease payments are actually included as an as incurred basis rather than in the initial measurement of it. I think that's just something to think about. But that said, the question number two is should variable lease payments, the staff is recommending that variable lease payments be presented as an operating cash flow. Do the boards agree?
Okay. Comments? Russ, you're on.
I think a lot of this has to do with the discussion that Pat McConnell brought up yesterday, and what is your view as to why the variable payments are not on the balance sheet to begin with? If you view it as it is not a current obligation, then, like Pat said, then I think that would extend you into the
this would go to an operating cash flow. If you view it as it is an obligation and a conceptual framework, and for cost-benefit reasons we're not going to initially measure it, then it seems like this ought to go to a financing. I'm personally in the latter camp, but recognizing I'm not sure exactly what our original basis was for why we excluded it.
This also presumes that this amount is perhaps just for 1 year. So to Russ's point, to the extent you come up with a variable lease amount that it goes beyond the year, I think it reinforces the need to just make that distinction, the split.
Other points, PK?
So just to understand, I wrote note to the, right next to this, but I feel that putting variable payments in operating, you're penalizing the entity to some extent, because for me, in my previous profession, the most important line was the operating cash flows. So it to some extent it's penalizing. Could you help me in situations where the variable payments are indexed based? How would that go into the? They're capitalized.
The decision I think yesterday was that that's actually going to that. This is for variable lease payments that are not in the liability to make lease payments. If there's variable, but it's in the liability, the payments on that liability run through financing.
That somehow doesn't sit well in my stomach.
Understood.
And I think we need to do something, because it's like variable payments, just because of their type, again, are going into different places, and I don't think it makes sense. But I'm with the bus. I feel variable payments are a financing activity, and they should be there. But if you want to put it, just because they're considered to be a period expense because you did not earlier recognize it, I can see the logic. I don't agree, but I can see the logic. But I think there is, it's all over the place.
It's really a function
of the only area we did not touch is investing, and we should touch that too, and then we're done. But otherwise, this is all over the board. Yeah. I prefer not to talk, but I...
No, that's...
Yes. You're thinking more like an analyst, PK. There's hope for you.
I just wanted to go back to Russ's comment. I understand why he isn't financing, but when I thought about the variable lease comment, or variable lease discussion we had a month ago or 2 months ago, whatever it was, I thought of it as you're paying as a lessee, you're paying the lessor some incentive for them to do something in the mall to get more foot traffic. So the lessor is spending money putting concerts and putting other things in the mall to get that traffic. To me, that was much more akin to an operating cost, had nothing to do with the financing of that particular transaction. Now, I'm not to say that there aren't other variables out there, but that was the one that kind of made me think in terms of it's much more of an operating cost related to things that are happening during that period.
Those are lessor costs you're talking about.
Well, lessor is incurring, but I as a lessee, want to incent the lessor to do things that are going to put foot traffic through.
Right.
And if they don't do that and I don't get the foot traffic, I don't get the higher sales, I'm not paying them for it. That's how I thought for it.
Ian?
Yes, having listened to this argument, and Pat, yesterday, Pat, you said you'd be shot down on the conceptual framework, but I don't think that's true. It's quite a hard question as to whether there is a liability, whether it's a recognition question or a measurement question. I'm in the camp with Russ that it's a measurement question, and therefore I don't agree with you, Hal. I don't relate it. I think it's all part of the lease liability. It's just that we can't measure it reliably, so we don't take it up. So I'd be firmly on the side of financing.
Thank you. Playboy?
I fully agree with that proposal. When I look at these issues, I'm linked to corporate environment, and take short-term lease example. You pay, hotels and taxis. I don't think when company prepare budget, they will think their capital expenditure. By contrary, a company want to rent buildings of floors for 5 years, and I would think their capital expenditure, and then will be financing aspects over there. And variable lease payments not capitalized, of course, we decide to distinguish them, it is controversial, but to some extent reflect the economics. You know, when we discuss variable-based payment not indexed, we say, you know, users, preparers look at this issue, they compare their revenues of, in Patricia's wording is, you know, under these scenarios, they compare the cash revenues and the cash expenditure, you know, like the hotel chains or the shopping mall, the seaside. So I think, personally, even though the cut is not fully, or we all accept it, but to some extent, to a large extent, reflect economics. So I fully agree with that proposal. I'm not sure whether users will look at these, you know, by the same way. I don't know.
Stephen?
Nothing else to add. I agree with Wegra. I think I agree with the staff proposal.
John?
Just a question. Are these variable lease payments really financing?
Thank you.
I thought you could have a situation where the entire lease payment was variable based on turnover. It would seem to me that there is some principal and interest there, not just financing. So I'm not sure there's a clear differentiation anyway. And I thought the reason that we excluded them was the uncertainty of whether you'd ever have to make the payment, where certain things we included. So,
Daryl, did you want to say something?
Okay. My experience with these variable lease payments is in a retail environment where there was a fixed payment and then there was a variable payment on top of it if certain sales goals were attained. And so in those situations, I know that we always considered it to be a period cost because it was being driven by the operating activity that happened in the period. So, you know, from that standpoint, and I know that not all situations are that, but I think a lot of them are. That's why I think of it as operating. So I support the staff recommendation.
I just wanted to add, I'm sorry, I neglected to say the part B of that question was that the expense related to these items would be disclosed. I don't think I said that in my TF. Of the question.
Where is the disclosure? Where?
In the notes to the financial statement.
Separate spots, just like in a cash flow statement or one place.
Simmer down.
Bemis, one number, hopefully one place.
All right. Okay. Any other points? Okay, so the staff is recommending that for the variable lease payments that are not included on the balance sheet in the measurement of the lease, that those should be classified in the cash flow statement as operating. Who supports the staff recommendation? IASB first. Okay, that's 13. FASB, who supports the staff recommendation? That's four.
And that's with the disclosure of the expense, right?
Right, so
that's the staff recommendation.
Disclosure of the expense separately in the notes.
Right.
Does everybody agree with that? Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks. The next issue is about supplemental cash flow disclosures that are made. We're recommending that the addition of rights of use assets during the period be disclosed as a supplemental cash flow item. That is, today, if you acquire PP&E in exchange for a note, you do a supplemental cash flow note saying, we got this PP&E in, but we didn't pay cash for it. This would be the same thing, and the notion is that users will take that number and probably adjust their investing activities for it to give you a real CapEx number. So do the boards agree with the staff recommendation?
Okay. Any comments? Does anyone disagree with the staff recommendation? Okay. No disagreement. Thank you.
Last item on the statement of cash flow paper. For short-term leases where the practical expedient is used, the staff is recommending that the cash flows for those leases be presented as an operating cash flow. Do the boards agree?
Any disagreement with the staff recommendation?
if you elect the option to not put it on your balance sheet, you go to operating. But if you elect the option to put it on your balance sheet, you go to finance.
If you don't elect a practical expedient, so you're treating it like all your other leases, it would be in the liability and therefore be in financing. I mean, yeah.
Did you consider classifying lease payments all in the same category? Okay, all is one or the other. And then, as we have today, a disclosure below the bottom line of the cash flow statement, something called interest paid.
Right.
So that somebody can determine what the interest component of lease payments are, but they could always find all the cash payments related to leases in one section. They don't have to go hunting.
We have... Yes.
I'm asking, did you consider it?
Yes, we considered it. In interest, we are in the disclosure paper recommending the cash paid for interest for leases be disclosed, because we didn't think in the cash flow guidance you'd probably get one interest number. As far as the variable lease payments that are not included in the liability, we contemplated saying cash paid for those items combined with everything else to give you a cash rent number. We've talked about presenting cash basis operating expenses or expenses that are running through net income in financial statement presentation, and that's where the costs really start to come into play. And so what we've done in the appendix is lay out the expenses that we are disclosing, the various different lease expenses, and the items of cash flow that you would do adjustments to get back to a cash basis rent metric, but it's not precise to the actual cash flow. There's timing differences. So if you have a variable lease payment and you haven't made the payment on it during the year, obviously the difference between the expense and the payment is going to be there. But we thought it was a decent proxy, although not perfect.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so with that, does anyone disagree with the staff recommendation, which would be that the leases that are accounted for according to the exception for short-term leases would be classified as operating cash flows? We have one FASB board member. Okay. Can I make a suggestion or at least put forward an idea? After we write these up, I would like to talk to some of the investors who viewed these as financing and some of the investors who viewed these as period costs and make sure that this set of decisions is coherent for those folks so that we're not mixing and matching and not helping anybody. Tom?
We did have that conversation with ICAC. And they said after this whole set of things, the most important thing for them is that in one place and location, if we treat this sort of as financing in a statement of financial position and a statement of comprehensive income, but they want to think it as operating, we've got to put all in one place all the expenses that are in the income statement so that they can undo the financing treatment and then be able to insert what they think would be the outcome if it was an operating item. They want to put it, and so I think we'll see in Appendix B of 190 that in paragraph 8 there is a recommended disclosure of putting those all in one place. And I'm only voting for some of this cash flow stuff all over the place if we've got the disclosures and the disclosures are in one place so that they can make that adjustment.
Right. It's the 5D Appendix B, paragraph 8. We assemble all of the pieces. It wasn't in the paper as a recommendation because we prepared this afterwards, but if we want to have that discussion, we can do that. But it's after paragraph 8.
Okay. Lee?
I do agree with your suggestions, Leslie. I think we need more feedback. And I would be surprised personally if we did not find some users telling us some are financing and some are operating expenses.
Okay.
All right.
Nick, are you handling the next paper as well?
Yes,
okay. That's 190, you said?
FASB number 190, ISB agenda, paper 5D. And this is going into the disclosures. I'm going to jump right in.
Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, I was going to go one line.
Okay.
I'm sorry? 190. 190, yes, 190. 5D.
D as in David,
yes. The first issue that we're discussing is a requirement to disclose the reconciliation of beginning and ending balances. At the time of this paper, the staff was split on this. However, since then, we've done some work, and we've done an exercise where we actually analyzed some financial statements. We were asked some questions by one of our constituents to kind of go through the exercise. And after doing it and discussing how the staff felt initially versus where we are, the staff does have a recommendation. And our recommendation is to reconcile the beginning and ending balance of the right-of-use assets broken down by underlying asset, and to reconcile the liability to make lease payments singularly, one number reconciled.
Reconcile what is singularly?
I mean, instead of the exposure draft required that the liability also be broken down by underlying asset, and we've received enough feedback that once the liability is established, it's really managed as a liability. There's no difference between a two-year lease on this or that. So those are the two pieces of the staff recommendation, I guess, discussion, and do the board's agree.
Thank you. Comments?
Comments on all the questions?
Yeah.
Okay,
go ahead.
Okay.
This one.
I guess I don't understand why, because it is useful, and I know I use this kind of information, a range of discount rates employed in lease arrangements wouldn't be disclosed. To my mind, it's absolutely critical.
The range. Okay.
You're saying to not disclose information about discount rates. I can understand, you know, you wouldn't necessarily get into creating a table, particularly for companies that have hundreds or thousands of leases. But it helps when you're distinguishing between a high-yield company and an investment-grade company what their cost of lease capital is, okay, if you will. So I think that's an important point. The other thing that isn't covered in this paper that is introduced by this project was the notion that lessors and lessees will break out the payments that represent the right of use and that which represents service arrangements. And I think that's going to be important. So I think we need to have a disclosure requirement for the payments that are part of a lease arrangement that are not being accounted for as a right-of-use asset and not being capitalized. So we need the disclosure of the obligation, even though we're not accounting for that service arrangement as a right-of-use asset. In other words, the executory element, if you will, that many of us would have preferred to have seen on the balance sheet, but we passed on that issue, right?
But doesn't
so
it become
a quasi-debt number that we decided not to put on the balance sheet?
Because it's contractually obligated.
Yeah, but wouldn't it be subject to any of the disclosures in RevRec? In other words, we're bifurcating out
on
services.
This side. These are lessons.
Ah, good point. Yep. Wait, hold on. Okay.
We'd all be better off.
I'm not saying against or agree, but there will be a consistency issues between this kind of commitment with others.
Well, it's contractual.
Exactly, contract, you know.
Yeah, this is in executory, really, in nature, because you have a contract.
But my question is whether we require disclosure of all kinds of executive contract liability.
But you're performing here. You know, that's the way I look at it.
I think it's executory or not executory. It's not based on whether you have a contract or not. It's based on whether you have performed your portion of it. Then it leaves the executory.
Right.
So,
okay, let's get back to the queue here. Talk.
Yes. Just let me talk about the reconciliation in general from the viewpoint of preparers, because I was a preparer up until last month, and I would like to share my experience while I'm still fresh. Actually, reconciliation is necessary in every case, and we do reconciliation every time in every occasion because we need to confirm whether the figures are correct, and normally preparers are ready to explain what the reconciliation to their management or their auditors, but the requirement in the accounting standards is a different story. When it comes to the disclosures in the financial statement, a preparer has to confirm whether the disclosure itself is correct. So that means they have to reconcile whether the reconciliation was correct. So that means the reconciliation on reconciliation disclosure. So therefore, actually, the burden which preparers has to suffer is much larger than the outside world people imagine. It is not a simple story, just you have a data, just disclose it. So we have to take it in our mind. And one other thing I have to point out on the requirements in the accounting standard is accounting standards requires to all the constituents. And of course, there is a judgment. Management can judge whether it is significant or there is a materiality or not. However, to check the materiality, whether it is material or not, itself is also the burden to the preparers. So therefore, I understand the necessity itself, but the requirement for rollover and reconciliation is sometimes imposes a very heavy burden to the preparers. So I would like you to take it in your mind.
Thank you. Hal?
I'm glad you raised this issue because I had made a note next to paragraph 12 saying why the divide. I want to make sure I understood your position. It's not that the work is onerous because you already do it. You agree that it's important to understand the change from number to from point A to point B. So is the issue solely a materiality issue? It lowers the level of materiality, it lowers that threshold and makes it more difficult, and you're conveying a level of accuracy that doesn't exist? Or is that there's a sense that you have to disclose every single number to get you from point A to point B, as opposed to saying, here are the two or three big numbers, and then everything else is an other? I'm trying to understand what the issue is.
Right.
So
my point is just in general as a reconciliation and disclosure. Mm-hmm. And reconciliation, we'll do the reconciliation every time and explain to the management. And in that case, we'll scrutinize every single figures.
Every single
number. Yeah, every
right.
single
yep.
figures. Okay. And but there are some areas which we do understand or which we share the common knowledge between management and actual accountant or auditors. So therefore, normally reconciliation procedure would not be so difficult. However, when it comes to the disclosure, and disclose it in the financial statement, not disclosure just one-on-one or some other explanation. So it needs to be self-explanatory and should be 100% accurate as a disclosure. So then, in that case, preparer has other burden to make it as a fair disclosure.
In some level of aggregation of those reconciling items would not help in that process by aggregating some
helps.
Of them?
It helps. It do helps. However, even aggregating some area, so again, in what part should we aggregate? In what concept shall we aggregate? Is always the issue for the preparers.
Okay.
So that's the point I want to share with you.
Okay.
Thank you. Other points? Okay. Let me take... sorry, Pat.
You're proposing, if I understand it correctly, to eliminate the disclosure of options and leases.
disclosure of options and leases.
Purchase options.
And it seemed to me that that was very important information. Not the ones that are at the money, because they, as you say in your paper, they can always buy the asset at its fair value. So an at-the-money option or a right of first refusal isn't. But if they have an option that is at a fixed price that might be in or out of the money, that's sort of useful information because it speaks to the financial flexibility of the organization, so that if rentals start to go to the moon and they have an option to purchase, they're in a much better position than perhaps their competition that didn't have options to purchase. So it seems to me that information about the purchase options would be very useful information for assessing financial flexibility.
So we're not talking about the options that you have a significant economic incentive to, and therefore they're already in.
No.
It's kind of the in-between.
Right.
Understood.
Okay.
Philippe? To that point, I think I would even go as far as disclosing all options, all purchase options, whether at money or not, because not all leasing contain purchase options. There are contracts which have purchase options and others who don't. That don't. So I think it's important to the users to know whether there is an option. And the second information is whether it's at money or special price. This is second, well, it's important as well, but I think I will start with all options.
Okay. Let's take these questions as they're presented by the staff, because I want to make sure we've got explicit consideration of each of these points. Question one on page 7. First, do board members agree with the staff recommendation to retain the requirement to do a reconciliation of the right-of-use asset by underlying asset type? Let me just take that first. Does anybody disagree with the staff recommendation? Okay, I have one IASB board member. Okay, the second question was, to present a roll forward of the liability, but to have that be in the aggregate, not by the underlying asset type, which is a change from the ED. Do people agree with the staff recommendation on that? Anyone disagree? One ISB board member. Yeah. Right. Okay. Russ?
Well, I wanted to ask Philippe, was his disagreement the disaggregation or the actual
reconciliation? Oops, Philippe, I got it.
I think reconciliation is not needed given information that we decided to put in the cash flow statement and the maturity analysis, which we also require. So I think just an overkill. It's an overkill. We set, I think, a duplication of information that people can find elsewhere. And in general, we had a discussion 2 years ago in Norwalk when we were discussing last the financial statement presentation project. And I think we came to the conclusion at the time that some of the information that was required in the direct cash flow statement would just do an overlay of information with reconciliations. And here we do require some information in the cash flow statement. We decided this morning, and I voted against it, by the way. Because I think it's either or, it's not two types of information.
Well, I am supportive of this, but it does strike me as somewhat odd that we're going to reconcile these financing obligations and not other financing obligations. It seems like what we're doing on roll forward is we're doing a piecemeal approach based on when we're getting around to doing the standards of the project and not more of a macro thought process about roll forward. I'd rather we do that. But that said, that's not currently on the joint agenda, so I'll take what I can get.
I don't see what is so special with lease obligations that we will require some special disclosures that we don't have for normal loans or even for pension liabilities.
Well, and then one of the other recommendations in here is about treating these as non-cash arrangements. It could start to become overwhelming.
Well, what I think special about leases is we taken one committed set of cash flows and blown it apart in the statements all over the place. We've got short-term lease payments in one part of the cash flow statement. We've got interest one place. We've got financing the other place. We've got non-lease components segregated out. We've got variable payments different than fixed payments. I think that the roll forward is bloody important, but it's only a partial picture. Somehow, if I want to understand a lease contract, I think I've got to bring back together all the stuff that we blew apart to understand the committed cash flows that are that are in the contract. And so I think not only is the roll forward absolutely important, but it doesn't go far enough to bring this all together. There are a bunch of other stuff that we're paying that's not in the roll forward because of what we've decided to do with the liability.
Just blow it all up, so now you can see all the pieces.
You can't see all the pieces, though. You look at the cash flow statement. Variable payments are buried in net income.
That's right. On our happy faces.
But I want to raise the point, are we going to bring this together for the users after we've blown it all apart?
Yeah, I 100% agree with Tom. You know, next time I draw a map for any of you, I'm just going to give you all the street names in random order and not show you how they're connected. And that's basically what we're doing here. We're giving people all the street names and no map. So I also agree with Russ's comment that at some point we'll probably need to look at the bigger picture issue. Because, you know, I'm a strong advocate of roll forwards. To Tuck's concern, I am duly concerned, and I think you've expressed it well. And I would encourage the staff to include some guidance here in terms of what does it mean to give a reconciliation. It's not the 100 items that may be necessary for internal management, but some higher level of aggregation. Hopefully we can bridge some of these gaps and concerns about reconciliations and roll forwards.
Okay, so based on those points, does anybody want to change their view on the need to provide a reconciliation of the liability? Okay. Let's go on to the maturity analysis, Nick.
Sure. So maturity analysis is discussed in paragraphs 29 through 49. There's strong support for this disclosure from users. A lot of the objections in the comment letters were very tied in with what was included within the liability to make lease payments when the disclosure was prepared. And so since then, decisions have been reached which I think addressed a lot of those concerns. And so we are, regardless of the preparer's comments about the maturity analysis, being that we think that some of that concern has been addressed, we are recommending that the liability to make lease payments, the maturity analysis of that number continue to be provided. Do the boards agree?
You want to tee up all the items?
Sure, all
those,
sure.
Too, please.
Absolutely. So in addition, we received comments on the time bands. That is the first 5 years and then the number thereafter. Some people said that this should be in line with IFRS 7, which gives you flexibility in that disclosure. However, it seemed that most respondents found that the five-year disclosure was appropriate, and so we're recommending to retain the guidance in the exposure draft for 5 years and then the amount thereafter. The staff is not recommending the requirement of the discount rate used. We felt that that information, we have both undiscounted and discounted amounts, and you could probably do the adjustment with the maturity analysis to get to the number if desired. And then finally, we're recommending an additional maturity analysis, if you will, of the commitments, the lease is already committed to but not yet commenced. So there's a requirement in the ED currently about information about leases not yet commenced. We're saying that that information is probably useful because it's about committed cash flows. But if you're going to give that information, give it separately, and when are those cash flows going to come due on leases not commenced? Those are all the recommendations about the maturity analysis.
Thank you. Darrell?
Just to clarify, Nick, was it contemplated we would have undiscounted commitments for the 5 years, and then just like now with the capital lease disclosure, we'd pull out an interest number to get to a liability that ties to the balance sheet?
Yeah. if you read the requirement in the ED, it kind of alludes to referencing back to the number, but it doesn't actually explicitly say require a reconciling back to the number. So we kind of mocked up what we thought how that would read when we go to the next phase of this, and so we might change some of the wording around to say reconcile.
But does that have the, if I understood the recommendation, we're saying don't start accounting for a lease until the commencement date.
That was,
and hit the measurement at the same time, pick your rate at that date, et cetera. Does this have the effect of...
Well, it would be undiscounted, same as the other cash flows.
Okay, but to the follow-up question of whether you are going to try and provide something to help somebody reconcile what would be on the balance sheet.
Right, so...
Seems like it's changing the earlier...
Well, if you go to Appendix B...
Yeah. I'll get you in a second, Kristen.
And it would be page 6. Okay. And it's boxed off as requirement, paragraph 85 from the ED, modified for our recommendation.
Okay, hang on.
It's the 85 box.
Yeah, please.
If this disclosure was required for the committed and not yet commenced leases, how would you calculate the amount to be disclosed? So that means you have to make in advance all the calculations of what could be recorded as a liability if it was already commenced, which means to bring forward all the calculations, the estimates, all the judgments that have to be made upon the commencement of the lease. Or do you just disclose what?
Mm. That was the exact question I was asking.
Okay. So there's other assumptions that you would have to. That those assumptions might be as of the commencement date. Is that the issue? And
yes.
So you haven't gotten there yet?
Yes.
I hadn't contemplated that.
Okay. Stephen?
I don't disagree with the 5 years and the analysis, but it seems odd that it's inconsistent with what we do for debt financing, but then maybe we need to review that rather than change this. Right. However, is it the requirement, or is it that there is provide information to meet an objective, the minimum is the 5 years plus total amount thereafter? How is it going to be phrased? I'd like it to be the objective is to provide information to enable users to do this, this, and this. And then this is a presumption that we need this to meet that objective, but it could be more than this. I'm thinking of companies with very long-term leases, just
right.
Having that lump amount for year 6 to infinity
so
doesn't seem very good.
So the recommendation you would make is basically the same except to say at a minimum 5 years, and then thereafter, but...
If necessary to meet the overriding objective that we have at the beginning. My second question is, there's nothing in here about disclosing the fair value of a liability. Now, I know that we discussed this, rejected it for the ED, but I'd like to disclose the fair value of the liability, but you haven't said anything about it.
I haven't said anything about it.
And why was that?
I don't have a good answer for that.
Go and ask for it.
Well,
I would say no.
I think a lot of the users ask for it.
If we're not including options in that, how would you do it?
John, go ahead. Can you repeat it?
Carry on.
If you're not including options in the liability as options, how would you do the fair value?
Well, it's the fair value of the amount that has been reflected in the balance sheet.
It's not fair value.
Well, I mean, we do it for debt. We allow for changes in interest rates, and that fair value for debt liabilities is disclosed. You could do exactly the same thing for a lease liability, taking account interest rate changes.
But is that the amount you could settle the contract for? That's the objective of fair value, and I don't think you meet that objective. Now, you could say a fair value.
Well,
like,
we're effectively bifurcating the contract into the amount that we're reflecting in the balance sheet and then the options, the variable payments, which we're dealing with differently.
Would you settle it for?
I mean, well, it's if you're doing an enterprise value approach to DCF valuation, and you're not including, and the lease commitment is treated like debt financing, then you need to deduct the fair value of liabilities to get to an equity value. I mean, that's why you need the fair value information for claims on the business. If we're regarding this as a claim, then you need fair value information about those claims.
Thank you. Elka?
Why do we dispose fair value for debt?
Financial instrument.
I don't want to add to the discussion on fair value for debt, but rather go back to your first comment on make it a principle for the maturity analysis, which I perfectly agree with. But then you said minimum is the 5 years plus then the bulk, and I'm not sure whether I would go that way. Because you're right for someone who's got a lot of very long-term leases, but for someone who's got only some leases, you then shut the door for considering materiality and to go for just 3 years or for something which is more appropriate in that case. So it could be rather an example, but not a minimum.
Tom?
I support the recommendations, but my fear is that if we look at page 6 of the appendix, and you look at a disclosure that says total future lease payments summed after 5 years and thereafter, that these are not the total future lease payments. What's excluded from there is variable lease payments, short-term lease payments, non-lease components under it within the lease. And so, well, my fear is that the users are going to take this particular disclosure and believe what they're being told is the committed cash flows under leases, and they're not. That's not what this is. So I would like to suggest that we augment this schedule with those other cash flow requirements that are committed to in leases, because is that not what we're trying to achieve? Are you not trying to achieve with this disclosure the cash flow commitments?
Yep. Well, this is cash, not a liability. You're talking about, you said that the disclosures are incomplete, right? We've already decided for short term that we're going to disclose what the expense is as a proxy. Later today. Okay. We're going to review that disclosure. But in terms of any other payments that are not included in the liability, right, you want to include those now in these disclosures?
Yes.
Yes, I want to augment it to the schedule because it is implied here that the total future lease payments are $25,099. That's not the cash flows in the total future lease payments.
What I'm saying is the reason why we didn't include those amounts in the liability to begin with was the difficulty in coming up with those numbers.
Yeah.
I mean, you're defeating the purpose for the decision we made. You're going to require people to track that information, to make those assessments, et cetera, and that's why we decided not to include it in the liability.
Yeah.
I would say that the reason we're not requiring that is not because of the difficulty of determining those numbers.
Well, it is for some people that voted for it.
Okay, but the reality is if you have a contract and you're determining, or your lessor is determining for you, the payment for the right of use asset, and they're separating from that those payments which are considered to be service elements, I don't think there's a difficulty there. I think the issue is the size of the liability that nobody wants to book on their balance sheet. That's the principal reason why we didn't go down there. And we said this project wasn't about recording executory contracts. I accept that. But to the extent that you're contractually obligated, for example, to Xerox, once you take that Xerox machine to take their services too, pursuant to a contract, I think that's valuable information. We heard from users that they would like to know what the committed payments are under contractual arrangements.
We don't do that for other executory contracts.
We don't, but because we're dealing with this project at this point in time, and because it is subject to these contracts, I think it is valuable information. And we've heard specifically that they want to see this information.
Okay.
I was
going to suggest. I think Tom's point has a good point in that the label may be wrong, and that we could say recognized obligations associated with leases, but then some kind of qualitative disclosure about other potential commitments for variable payment, short-term leases, other executory to give a warning signal, which I think is coming.
Yeah, that's my suggestion.
Yeah, but I guess my concern, which is maybe similar to what Larry was saying, is that that's also a partial picture. If it happens to be part of a lease arrangement, we're going to disclose it. But if it doesn't, it may not be subject to the disclosure requirements. In other words, if it's ancillary to a lease contract, we're going to make you disclose it, but it wouldn't otherwise be disclosed.
Well, I'm talking about short-term leases and variable payments. I don't understand what you mean.
Sorry. Tom's point was broader than that.
Well, there's three categories: short-term leases, variable payments, and non-lease components.
And each Pat mentioned services.
Well, that's the non-lease components.
Sorry. Yep.
Yeah.
Okay.
And each of those we could discuss separately, as they each have different issues.
Hold on.
Sure. But wasn't there a requirement in IFRS for disclosure of service arrangements, committed service arrangements? Wasn't it an interpretation?
IFRIC 4,
yeah. You might be thinking of what was in IFRIC 4, where we had our definition of the lease issue, which is a point that I think Nick comes to later on in this paper, which is, okay, if we've got, you know, in totality some contracts that met the definition of the lease today, where you did have these required disclosures, and now under our revisions to that, they fall out, then maybe you've got a question of loss of information.
Exactly.
I think that, Nick, you come to that later in the paper.
That's another issue.
So you're taking information away that might otherwise be in a set of financial statements prepared in accordance with IFRS. It's kind of hard to vote for that.
Interesting. Let's break down this cash commitments. Variable lease payments aren't going to be included there because the whole point is they're not committed because you don't know what it's going to be. So you can't disclose that here. Right?
You can disclose the qualitatively what it is.
Yeah. You could disclose that it exists.
Yes.
I that doesn't really belong here to me, but I agree that you should do that. Short-term leases, well, they're short-term, so they're not going to roll out beyond a year anyway. And you're going to we're going to talk about the disclosure of the expense number, which frankly will include everything, which probably is even better. The committed services, I think, is a great point. I think to the extent that you're going to be making a lease payment on a car of $1,000 a month and only some of that is going to end up in your liability because some of it's stripped out services, I think if you're committed to $1,000 a month as part of your lease contract, even though it's not in the lease liability, I think that's a valid point. And you know, just signal it. I think you have to, at a minimum, signal it. But I think it's an actual commitment.
Did we require that disclosure in RevRec?
On the seller's side?
Yep. Oh, again, I'm doing the exact opposite again. Sorry, I see your point. Yep. Okay. Okay, so let's look at question two and take them one at a time. The first element of it is to continue to include a maturity analysis of undiscounted cash flows for the liability to make lease payments. Does anyone disagree with that requirement? Okay, that's no. And then to retain the time bands for at least in the first 5 years and then a total afterwards, and then Stephen made a suggestion to say at a minimum, and then if you need to do more to satisfy the disclosure objective, to do so. Do people disagree with the time bands as amended by Stephen? Okay, no. And then the third was the staff recommending not to require disclosure of the discount rates used to calculate the liability. I know one person disagrees with that. Do other people disagree with the staff recommendation to not require disclosure of the discount rates? ISB first. Two. FASB? One.
We are requiring the reconciliation to the present value of the liability, right?
Correct. If you disclose the
based on the wording, I don't think it's a stretch from what the ED said, although the ED didn't specifically say and reconcile it back to the liability bounds. So, I mean, we could just make sure that that's the decision, that the undiscounted amounts will be reconciled back to the liability.
Okay, so then that makes the next question very important.
Well,
it's
just a moment.
So it'll be the weighted average.
Everybody's off mic, guys.
Implied in that reconciliation.
Okay, so
get back into it.
But not the right.
Yeah.
Question. I mean, today under IFRS and U.S. GAAP, you disclose the range of discount rates embedded in obligations, mm-hmm. You know, bank debt, debentures, senior unsecured, subordinated, whatever. Why wouldn't you do that here?
As far as the ranges go, I mean, the range and the weighted average, I guess, are two different things. Based on what you said with the, why the range might be useful, I think it could be. It could be a difference in ranges from one company to the next, and it might tell you something.
Your point is the current disclosure requirement isn't a range. It's the weighted average.
Well, that was something that was asked for more. That rose to my attention more so than the range.
Okay.
I've seen ranges that also range very far apart, and so that I always wondered the utility of that. But.
The basis for a question.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. But so this point about reconciling back to what would be on the balance sheet makes, I think, the next question very important, which is, would you provide the maturity analysis for undiscounted contractually obligated, in other words, the ones that are not yet on the balance sheet, which raises the concern that Philippe and I were mentioning before, that you're essentially requiring a start date for the calculation sooner than what we had agreed upon previously for the accounting, because you'd have to basically do the calculations to satisfy the disclosure requirement.
Well, I'm sorry, and maybe I just don't completely understand. I know that there might be some things that you kind of have to contemplate, and I get that to get to what the minimum contractual would be, but it wouldn't be included in reconciling back. You wouldn't have to discount it to a number of what the liability will be. As illustrated, it's just kind of breaking it down by the time bands, the minimum undiscounted gross cash flow.
Okay. That's what you guys are asking us to vote on, but then there was this other idea of trying to reconcile that. So first,
make sure on this. Nick, is it contemplated that the leases not yet commenced in this disclosure would be leases that when they are commenced, the liability would be on the balance sheet?
Right.
That's right.
Mark?
The question that Philippe and Leslie asked is a good one. And so if it's just the committed cash flows for the leases that are not yet commenced, I actually think it would be okay. You know, but if you, the question is, are you going to be splitting out the services to come up with that number? That's the part where I get the concern. That's the part where I get the concern. So I would imagine that there's some flexibility here since you're not reconciling to the balance sheet number. If this were leases not yet commenced, gross cash flows associated with leases not yet commenced, I would think that you could do it. You're not going to have to tie it back to a balance sheet number that doesn't exist yet anyway. But otherwise, I don't see how you could start splitting out services in contracts that haven't yet commenced.
But then if we're going to do that, why not do what Tom and Pat said with regard to those leases that will be on the balance sheet, all of the cash commitments?
Right.
We're going to do it for those that that are not yet on the balance sheet.
Right. So what I was going to do is ask the questions that the staff prepared analysis on in the memo, and then I was going to go through some of the extras that people have suggested. Okay. Was the staff recommending that we add the disclosure of the committed cash flows that have not yet commenced?
That's right.
Okay, sorry, I just didn't. So who would support the staff recommendation?
I must admit this wasn't an original thought, but I won't attribute it. The ED asked for information about the principal terms of any lease that has not yet commenced if the lease creates significant rights and obligations. So in other words, that's more qualitative than quantitative. And is that a good idea to just stay with what we had in the ED?
Maybe one enhancement would be if you view it as a significant commitment, go ahead and provide the cash flows. But it's good in the sense, I think, it has a threshold. It needs to be a significant commitment, as opposed to making people disclose every commitment that hasn't started yet.
Yes, and having to add them up and work out if they're, you know, I mean, it could be large. If you think of a long-term commitment for a build-to-suit power station or something, then qualitative information on what the commitment is, I think, would be very useful. But trying to quantify it or a whole lot of them and put them together, probably not as useful.
Okay, so thank you for bringing that up. Even if you were not to support the staff recommendation, we would keep intact the disclosure requirement that Ian just mentioned. Okay, so who then would prefer that we add a specific quantitative disclosure of the commitments that have not yet commenced, a maturity analysis of contractual committed cash flows? ISB, who supports that incremental disclosure?
Can I ask a question? Is it only for those that will become liabilities when the lease commences?
I think Darrell made an important clarification. Yes.
Okay. So it's not all your committed cash flows for uncommenced leases.
But I would ask people to think that through, because when I ask the extras about services and things, those are not going to be reported on the balance sheet.
Okay. So when you say cash, total cash.
Yes, that's what it would be.
Not bifurcated for the services? I think that's what I heard people supporting.
Okay, I think...
All right, you're right.
Well, I was thinking, but this is for leases.
Exactly.
That's what the staff was thinking when we did this. This is for the leases. So this isn't for the piece of it that's not a lease.
Okay, so it does mean to provide this disclosure, you bifurcate out.
You'd have to determine what that...
Yeah, ahead of time.
You'd have to split it. That's what we were thinking.
Okay.
I just wanted to clarify.
Okay. Who would support a disclosure of the committed cash flows for leases that will be recognized on the balance sheet once the lease term commences? ISB?
I disagree.
We disagree because you have to split out the lease and non-lease components. And then it's not really the committed cash flows.
I agree with that.
FASB, who would support that incremental disclosure? That's two. All right, three. Sorry. Okay. Sorry. Three.
So
I don't have you on. So we'll go back to seven.
We didn't put to the vote the recommendation I put on the table.
I'm about to get to the
extras. All right.
Thanks.
My question is now the right time to do that? Let me just refresh on what the next issue is.
I think it would be.
So I've heard. We did vote on the range of interest rates, and that was declined by the majority of both boards, right?
We vote on that?
Yes.
Right?
Yes, we did.
No,
we didn't vote
even
on the range.
Danielle, am I right?
Yes.
Okay. Then there was a suggestion that we require disclosure of the services that are embedded in a lease after they've been bifurcated out because they represent committed cash flows for the lessee. Do we need further discussion of that?
I actually had a question on that.
Yep. I don't know why, but...
My only question is, what about service contracts that are separate from a lease? So sign them simultaneously. That was the only thing.
Right.
Okay.
I don't know. It's not on the agenda. Does someone down here have a question? John?
I had the same. Do we require disclosure of that now under commitments anywhere?
Yes.
I just tried to look. I couldn't find it.
37 might have some.
I just looked in 37, couldn't find it. So I thought we did, but I don't see it.
There's an SEC disclosure, at least that I'm familiar with. where we do commitments.
Beyond a certain length?
I forget what the...
That's outside the financial statements, though.
Right.
Yeah, it's outside. Yeah, no, it's... Yes.
Okay, so... So let me ask the question. Do people believe that if services are embedded in a lease and we are requiring that they be separated out, that there should be a separate disclosure of the committed cash flows relating to the servicing piece?
I would agree with other service companies.
As part of this project?
If we do it for service contracts, then we'll be picked up.
Okay, so John was off mic. John said his vote is contingent on that being an existing requirement for other service arrangements.
Yeah, so you don't have to vote on it. You don't have to vote on it.
Okay, so then do we need to vote?
We don't need to do something specific to that. Somewhere else. Well,
yes, you may. Pat?
It's been my experience over many years that when users have wanted a particular disclosure requirement, people have used the logic that John has used. Well, we don't do that for other things, therefore we're not going to do it for this. So we don't do it for this. And then when we get to the other thing, they say, well, we're not. Why should we do it for this? Because we didn't do it for that. And so you don't do it for that either. And so...
I absolutely accept what you say, and I'm going to remind you of that in hedging.
Stephen?
All right,
peace.
We're not trying to put any fertilizer in this disclosure.
I just wanted to support Pat and beat up John a bit more. I agree. I think this is a big omission. I think staff are checking, are you at the moment, about whether this is an existing disclosure, but it isn't, and that's one of the big problems that we have is not having disclosure of these committed cash flows, which can be very substantial. Yeah, of course, it's a separate project, but to Pat's point, I think we've got an opportunity here of making an incremental improvement.
Katrina?
This may not be helpful at all, but I always ask. First of all, we were trying to have a look at IFRS 7. We're not sure it's already a disclosure. But I suppose I would just ask, I'm just wondering how we see this applying. I think it is quite important, the fact that we're not asking for this disclosure for other separate service arrangements. Because I'm thinking, when do we intend it to apply? Then if I'll sign a contract today, then instead of having my car servicing in the same contract, I'll just write two contracts then so that they're two separate things, so I won't have to disclose it. And it just seems to be that I'm not saying they should, that all committed, you know, service contracts shouldn't be disclosed, but it just seems wrong to ask for this when somehow it's embedded in a lease contract, whereas, you know, how do we tend to apply? Are then we're going to write lots of rules to try to say, well, no, if you write a separate contract on the same day, well, what if it's 3 days apart, or what if it's 2 months apart, or how does this actually get applied when we're not asking for the disclosure for separate service contracts?
So we cover that in the revenue recognition project. We talk about contracts that are contemplated
and entered into at or about the same time. Essentially what you're saying, Katrina, is that if you enter into some kind of structuring to avoid this disclosure, that's permissible. We're condoning that, essentially, is really,
I think my point is back to something Leslie said. It seems to be, we think this is, but this is only partial information. I think that if we were going to ask for all committed cash flows, that would be very useful information. But if we're only asking for it when the services are part of a lease contract, it's still only partial information.
I don't disagree, but we have an opportunity here. We have a project that deals with lease arrangements. And part of the decision-making process here was to separate those elements of the contract that represent right of use payments and those which represent services and other arrangements. And the lessor community told us that they could do that. The lessee community preferred that and endorsed that. It's actually going to be done as a part of the exercise to come up with the numbers to put on the balance sheet. So here's an opportunity to provide good information about cash flow commitments related to leases, not the universe. And yet we're staring at it and we're saying, no, let's not do it. And I'm not hearing any sound analysis or rationale for not doing it other than, well, we don't do it over in this project and we don't do it over in this area.
Okay, yeah.
Does it make sense?
Well, scope creep is very common in our projects, and I think this is an excellent example of how we try to solve a problem. We have a lot of financial obligations that are not on the balance sheet, so we said, let's make a project and get them on the balance sheet. And now we're saying, why don't we add a few more goodies onto this? And I think it's obvious that what Petrina is saying, it will happen. It came to the advice we got right away. Make separate contracts, just separate it, fix it so you don't get it on the balance sheet. If we are to get on the balance sheet, we must do it in a proper way. And then we must have a separate project on this. We can't just sort of add it on ad hoc because we just now think it's a good idea.
Larry?
This might surprise some people, but I actually appreciate everything Pat McConnell said. I think that these are associated with particular contracts, and to the extent that we brush it off to the side, we run the risk that later on when we have a comparable type of thing, we say, well, we didn't do it there, so we're not going to do it here, and we just continue. I think, and I don't know this, but I suspect that many of us think that committed cash flows is probably an important disclosure, and if we had room on our agenda, we might take that on. So, you know, when you can get incremental improvements in GAAP, it might be useful to seize the opportunity and do that. So for those where it's a part of the contract, I would support including it. However, for those aspects of the contract unrelated to services, but where we've made decisions not to include it in the liability, such as contingent payments, I think there are specific reasons why we made those decisions, and I would stick with those and not require those to be disclosed.
Okay. We're at time for this session, so I'm going to ask people to be very brief, please. Ian?
It's just – sorry, I turned it on.
Yep, that's okay.
Just contrary to Larry's opinion, I can see the point. It's some more information we could pile on. I just think – piling on this information piecemeal, which is what we're doing. I know it's related to contracts we're already analysing, but in terms of service contracts, it's piecemeal, and I think it's dangerous to do it.
Okay. John?
And I have the opposite opinion. I think it's dangerous to put a footnote that's incomplete to say the cash flows under the lease contracts are less than what they are committed. I will concede that the short-term lease payments, the short-term contracts, we don't need, because we're going to have the expense. I think we're going to vote on that. And the variable payments, we don't know, but we should be describing that qualitatively. But I think we will have a misleading disclosure to say the cash commitments under the lease are, in this example, $25,099, when that's just not true.
Tom, the lead-in in that disclosure is correct. It says it's a schedule of the maturities of the liabilities recognized. It's only the description in one piece of that note that's not very good. It doesn't really solve your problem. You think the disclosure is good, and it probably is, but if they can change the wording, at least it won't be misleading.
I'm John? Not sure that the users will recognize when we say that it's just recognized by the lease.
Yeah.
I'll be brief. I asked a question whether this was required elsewhere, because I thought it was. But given that it isn't, I don't think this is anticipating what we might do somewhere else or correcting something. I see this as a bit different, and here's the difference. Standalone contract is different from I've separated out servicing, and sometimes very, very subjectively. And so it seems to me that that number is important because it's part of the whole. And one of our former board members was very concerned we weren't recognizing it as a liability anyway. So I do think it's different. We've said, yeah, break it out, but it is part of that contract, and how we break it out, I think, at times could be very arbitrary. So I think it is good information.
I agree with John. This is, continue on that analogy, Jim, you always used to talk about his BMW and $1,000 payment for his BMW. We're the ones breaking that apart. So we're the ones saying, break it apart. All we're saying here, some of us are saying here, is disclose the $1,000. That's all. We're the ones breaking it apart. So I would disclose the piece that we're breaking apart.
Okay, I'm going to call it. Who would support adding a disclosure requirement for the committed cash flows relating to services for the lessee? ISB first.
Six.
Hands sort of went up and down.
Six. ISB. FASB, who would support that disclosure requirement?
Four.
Okay, that's four. Okay, and then the last add-on.
Well, that doesn't. That's not
oh, sorry, sorry. Thank you. Okay, so, yep, please.
Find out if it is.
What is the requirement from a U.S. financial reporting standard situation? I mean, if this is already an SEC reporting requirement.
So the specific question is, are services included in that table of commitments?
Right, so I mean, maybe we could find that out over the break and see if we really have a difference.
Okay, so we're going to have someone look it up.
But I don't know.
Okay, I think that's a good suggestion. And we do have more time for leasing later. So before we close on this, just the last suggestion someone had made was to require disclosure of the fair value of the lease liability. Any further discussion? And some points were made about why we had it, about how you would do an as-if calculation because of some of the other decisions we had made. So actually, I guess let me ask, as Stephen suggested it, fair value relating to the provisions of the arrangement that are going to be accounted for as a lease, right? Okay. Who would ISB? Who would support adding that disclosure requirement? That's four. FASB. Who would support adding that disclosure requirement?
No.
Okay. That's zero. Okay. Now, Nick, there are more. Yes.
The suggestion from Pat on range of discount rate.
I thought we voted on that. We voted on that, and it was not accepted.
Okay.
Okay, thank you. We have more issues in this memo.
Yeah, there's a few more in this memo.
Kristen?
I have the SEC disclosure, if you want that, or do you want to bring it back? Go ahead. Okay, so the SEC disclosure is a tabular disclosure of contractual obligations, and it requires a tabular format. It gives specified captions, so long-term debt obligations, capital finance lease obligations is a line item required. And defined in that capital finance lease obligation, it says it means a payment obligation under a lease classified as a capital lease pursuant to our FAS 13. So that's what's required. An operating lease obligation. So then, again, operating lease obligation, it just is defining it as a payment obligation under that lease. So,
but it doesn't have an all other or some other sweeping category?
Sure it does. So long-term debt obligations, capital finance lease, operating lease, purchase obligations, other long-term liabilities reflected on the registrant's balance sheet under GAAP. So all long-term obligations should be encapsulated in this tabular requirement.
Is the purchase obligation also constrained to balance sheet recognition?
Purchase obligation means an agreement to purchase goods or services that is enforceable and legally binding on the registrant that specifies all significant terms, including fixed or minimum quantities to be purchased, fixed, minimum, or variable price provisions, or the approximate timing of the transaction.
So it appears to be an existing SEC disclosure requirement. Do we want to make it part of GAAP is the question. Yes.
Is it audited?
Kristen, is that outside the financial statements?
Yes.
So if we were to continue and the majority vote, it would require to be in the financial statements and audited, which would be a change.
Which is a good change. But,
yeah, I think
right on.
But sorry, so that was consistent with the way the FASB vote was, right?
Yeah.
But so, wait, well.
As a former regulator,
guys, it's an SEC requirement.
You know, within the disclosure framework always have a separate part called the commitment. And that is outside the financial statement. And as I understand, that part, only the key idea is it's disclosed those significant ones, rather than we want to include everything, which are commitments, but seems not so significant. So I don't think I will support the idea.
Okay, so I guess the question for the group is, would any IASB board members change their vote to require this disclosure requirement? There was a minority previously. So one more time, IASB, who would support adding this disclosure requirement? Okay. Okay, it's still a minority.
Plus one.
Okay. Okay.
So, yeah, we did. It's down to five.
Okay. Daryl?
No, I didn't change my mind.
Considering the fact that on the FASB it was 4-3, should we ask the question the other way? Since it's already required in SEC guidance.
Yeah. Thank you, Daryl. I guess I was... projecting. on the FASB, who would be willing to change their vote to not require this as an incremental disclosure in U.S. GAAP to bring it into the audited financial statements? So. No. But now we're saying it's already an existing SEC. Oh, okay. Got it. Okay. So sorry.
In order to converge.
Yes.
Not only that, private companies will have a problem unnecessarily. They don't have to.
I'm going to ask who on the FASB still wants to add this incremental disclosure requirement. So that's four. Okay. So we move forward with a. Okay. I think that's enough on this. Do you want to try and finish this memo and then?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'd like to get as much done as possible.
Yeah. So, okay. Okay. Go ahead.
The next question is about the details of leases in paragraph 73. There was a lot of feedback on this, but quickly, 73A2 and A3. We still want to require, that's the information about contingent arrangements and lease term extension and termination items, along with developing implementation guidance for how those disclosures might look when you have a lot of leases, and we've taken a crack at that in the appendix. We're also recommending the removal of the disclosure of... existence and principal terms of options for the lessee to purchase the underlying asset, and the removal of the initial direct costs incurred on a lease. There was already some discussion about how the option to purchase might be useful. So,
okay.
Discussion or vote.
Anyone disagree with the staff recommendation? Sorry, I figured I'd try. Tom?
I agree with everything except the purchase option. I don't understand why we'd get rid of the purchase option, given that we've already incorporated it into the consideration, like a renewal or termination. A purchase option is being treated the same as those two other options in our decisions about lease term and about the liability. So I don't understand why we wouldn't also, if we're going to talk about renewal and termination options, it's just another form of option to extend the term. Fully extended, but it would seem to me that we should be talking about it.
Okay. Stephen, did you?
I agree with Tom.
Okay. Mark?
It's Paul.
Paul.
I wanted to raise a couple of points on this. One was the one Tom just made, but the others, in paragraph 50, you identify a whole list of things, some of which you specifically say you'll keep as disclosures, some of which in the question you say you're going to drop, and then three of which you're silent on in your recommendation. And even, so am I correct that in little Roman VI and VIII, you're going to keep
Yeah,
all of those.
There wasn't a lot of feedback really objecting to that. I think people saw the utility and understood. And
so the two you want to drop are four and seven.
That is
Seven, yeah.
Yeah.
All the others
yes.
remain. And then I share Tom's concern. I have one more point. In terms of the commitments, the three-point things that Tom identified, actually two of them are in here already in narrative form.
That's right.
But the one that's missing is the service commitments. Now, we just voted, and it looks like we're divided on whether to have a quantified, to try to quantify the service commitments. But I wonder whether, at least on the IASB side, where we did not get a vote for quantifying, should we add another item here for a description of the service commitments, similar to the description of the various other commitments in the leases?
Other, John?
On the options, I thought we made a decision. Certain options would be included in the liability, certain not. The ones included were those where there was an incentive that they would be exercised. It seems that on those that are included, we've included our best guess as to the terms. On those that aren't, we've kind of said, well, it doesn't look like that's going to become effective anyway, or it's not something that's a bargain. So I don't know why we need that. And it also seemed to me that it's not like an obligation, lessee doesn't have to exercise.
Just to refresh my memory, in terms of reassessing the options, didn't we come up with some criteria that you would use and reassess the likelihood of the option being exercised? So, in other words, it's going to be trued up over time, just adding
there becomes an economic incentive that you would include it at that time.
It would come into the liability at the time.
Right. So what's the incremental information that you would want? Pat, you had your light on anyway.
The fact that an option to purchase the leased asset at a price other than market, because it speaks to the financial flexibility of the enterprise, and if we reassess it in the future, it will impact the obligation that goes on the balance sheet if we're reassessing. So I think a user needs to know that those options exist, and that the enterprise may have an increased liability because of that, and it may affects their financial flexibility. If they have the right to buy and lease payments are going to the moon, they're in a better position than everybody else.
We're running way over now, so let's try and keep it brief.
Quick, if we would do this, I'd be a little concerned about double counting. I've already got some of them in the liability. Now I'm going to disclose potential to exercise the option at a price. So I would think you'd have to complicate it a little more and separate those that are in and those that aren't in. I'm just not sure it's worth the bank for the buck.
Seems to me that some options have been assessed and then are recognized, and some have been assessed and not be recognized, but they will be reassessed over time. And the fact that they will have to be reassessed needs for me to mean that there should be disclosure that they have been assessed and not recognized.
Okay. Let's take a look at the staff recommendations. The staff is recommending that the disclosures in paragraph 73A, 2, and 3 be retained. Does anyone disagree with the staff recommendation on that? No. Okay. So with respect to the purchase options, the staff is, and actually there were two pieces of this, the staff is recommending that we eliminate a specific disclosure requirement for purchase options and disclosure of the initial direct costs incurred on a lease. Let me first ask IASB, who supports the staff recommendation to remove those two disclosure requirements?
Eight.
How'd you get that? pull them up?
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8.
Okay, that's 8. FASB, who supports the staff recommendation to eliminate those disclosure requirements?
5.
Okay, that's 5. Can I ask IASB, would anybody be willing to change their vote? Oh, I thought you needed 9. I beg your pardon. Okay, all right. Okay, Nick, bring it home.
All right. This one's, this is just what we had talked about in a previous meeting was how a lot of users wanted to be able to get back to a rent expense type metric. After talking to a number of users, really they said with the other disclosures in place, what they would need is the interest expense and the interest paid related to leases. Do the boards agree? Oh, and also that the other issue here is some preparers, particularly those who get reimbursed for contracts where interest is disallowed, asked for a combination of those items into a single rent expense number so they could report it as rent expense, not to separate the interest and the amortization, though they said you could disclose the components of it. The staff is not recommending this. Do the boards agree with those two recommendations?
Steven?
So is this paragraph 78?
Yeah, I'm sorry. We're starting with 78. Yeah. Oh, yeah, 78 is the first piece, which is if you give the pieces, they can get back to you. Yes.
But 78 seems to me to simply give you cash paid for rent. If you start off with the total rent expense recognized.
That's right.
Take out the amortization, take out the interest, which gets to zero.
Right.
And then you add in the cash paid.
It doesn't get you to zero. There's other items in there, such as the variable lease payments that are an expense, but they're not included in the liability. And I think we've decided that that's
okay. So then it's a bit of a.
I don't have the components that come up to the total lease expense recognized. The components that come up to that, and this is also in the appendix, would be the variable lease payment expense that's not included in the liability. Possibly short-term lease expense, interest expense, and the amortization expense. Then what I'm showing after that is back out the interest and the amortization expense and actually put in the cash paid numbers, the cash paid for the liability, which will be in the roll vote.
So then the thing at the bottom is a mixture of accrual cash items.
And that's why it says proxy and it's not cash rent expense. We never quite get there.
Why can't we just say what the expense would have been under operating lease accounting?
Well, that's two. You'd have two models and disclosure.
Figure out which ones are operating.
Right.
That too.
No, I'm not saying.
So all. Those so words, in other words, convert all leases to operating.
I'm saying disclose the rent accruing in the period, unless there is rent-free periods or funny payments, in which case you straight line it. Which is what we do at the moment.
Which is what we do at the moment, but we wouldn't do that, so it would be doing two separate.
But this just seems such a confusing number.
It's not the best number. It doesn't get you. That's kind of the point of. That's why there's so many paragraphs here, is to kind of take you for the walk that says you'll never get back to what rent expense is today.
Unless you just ask
for it. Say what it is. That's right. Which we didn't recommend because. That's not the accounting that we chose.
But this is another way of presenting the information. So why should it be consistent with the accounting we've chosen?
Okay. Pat?
In support of what Steve say, that it's confusing and maybe not useful, the total lease expense recognized, the first number that you start this reconciliation with, includes the variable lease payments, is that correct?
That's right, and that would be, that's what I tried to illustrate in the appendix, I think it's after paragraph 8.
So if a user looked at this and they said, oh, well, I can take this number and just subtract it from operating income they would be double counting the variable lease payments, and they might not know it.
That's right.
Is that correct?
This was just to demonstrate for us what the math is to get back. I'm not saying this should. Yeah.
Exactly. So they might not even realize that they're double counting the variable lease payments when they then take this number as the surrogate for rent expense.
It's possible that they don't bring it into the initial number or they back it out. But yes, it's possible.
So that I think the idea of this disclosure was to help people that wanted to treat the rent expense as an operating rent expense and take out what was in operating income and put back what a cash number.
Right.
And this is neither a cash number.
No, it's not a cash number. It's not a cash right. number.
Again, we're running really late. Larry?
Okay, I'm sorry. I'm really starting to get confused as to what your objective is. Is it to disclose a cash number?
No, my objective was to provide the pieces that would allow a user to say, I know what the expenses are, and I know what the components I need to back out of the expenses and put in to get back to something that resembles what rent expense would have been.
Okay, but this formula in paragraph 78
right.
would get you a cash number, right?
It would get you back to...
Including variable payments?
It would get you back to something that's between cash and accrual, because you're going to have timing differences and the like.
Timing differences like what?
Like if you've accrued the contingent...
Forget about it. Let's say all the cash...
Okay.
Everything was right, paid then, by...
Yes, this is cash rent expense.
Isn't there a this more direct way to require
Why don't we just say cash rent?
Cash paid?
Yeah.
We can do cash paid for an expense, but... I mean, that's direct cash flow information that you're also doing piecemeal.
What's that? For leases.
Right. Right. Which circles us back into the first conversation.
Which, where the majority of both boards voted to bifurcate. I'm not
I think that what's needed when we talk to users is in paragraph 8 of your Appendix B.
Right. And that's what we've heard.
And so that's a way of bringing together or crystallizing this proposal that you have in this question. Note, not only does it list the expenses, all the expenses related to leases, but underneath it gives you the cash payments for principal and interest that would, if you pulled out the amortization and the interest expense, would be replacing that amount to get to the total operating expense. So I thought that was what you were recommending. It's not right what you did in question 4, but to get all the way there, that's what you'd need to do.
This was the conversation that said, okay, now take that and put it all together. And so we could illustrate it this way in the implementation guidance. We could explicitly require tabular presentation of the expenses. We didn't ask that question because we didn't think about it that
but
way.
But the users that have said that they think of these as operating leases said they'd be okay if we treated it as finance on the face of the statement as long as they had this in one place.
So the fact of the matter is that variable lease expense and short-term lease expense will be presented as operating leases. So
right.
Question 4 is only relating to the top two lines on this for the ones that are recognized on the balance sheet.
Right, but what's missing out of question 4 is the sentence below the list in paragraph 8 there.
Okay.
Total cash paid on the liability to make lease payments excludes amounts for variable chart is X. That's the principal and interest. That is the cash payment. So if you were to pull out amortization and interest expense, you got to replace it with something.
Yeah. Okay. Let's answer the question that the staff has asked here, and then we're later today going to be talking about some of these other items, I think. So question 4, do people agree that interest and interest expense and interest paid relating to leases that are on the balance sheet should be presented separately?
Or should be disclosed, yeah. Disclosed.
So basically that's the distinction between...
They won't necessarily get presented. We know that's going to happen. They're going to get lumped in.
Right, one or the other. Do people agree with that?
Yeah.
That we should be presenting the interest separately?
No disagreements.
Okay. And then the second, yeah.
So
I have a question about paragraph 89 that might play into that.
Okay.
If this is a good time to ask it. I'm concerned about the effect that our new accounting for leases is going to have on these cost recovery type contracts. And the first thought that I had was, it occurred to me, I'm wondering why, if recoverable, why these are being shown as an expense anyway. And then I started thinking, well, is there a connection here to the RevRec project where they're incurring this lease expense because of the revenue contract that they're doing? And so is there a connection here such that we could instead account for these as assets, and that would solve the problem?
It, sometimes it depends, your gross versus net question. Generally, the reason is you have your revenue recognition, then you have your costs. Sometimes cost recovery is not a direct cost recovery. It's an allowable cost within your overhead. Okay. And then you're over, then you're able to allocate an overhead rate into your contracts. So that's why it's a cost distinction.
So
not
it wouldn't
a
be
net
a direct
distinction.
Related to that. It's an allocation.
Could be direct or indirect.
Yeah. Okay.
So the staff is recommending that, consistent with the ED, we require separate presentation of interest and amortization and not allow people to combine that and call it rent expense from a presentation standpoint. Do people agree with the staff recommendation on that? Any disagreement? No. Okay, yeah, I feel the same way. Is there one question left?
Yeah, the final question I think we've kind of addressed in talking about the services. Again, there's certain arrangements that, because of the way a lease was defined versus how it's defined now, have fallen out of disclosure. And so the staff is recommending that we don't do anything in the leases project for that because it's outside of leases. But to Pat's point, yes, there's something that's going to be lost in disclosure.
Do people disagree with the staff recommendation to leave this out of the leases project? Okay. Any disagreement? Sorry. That, for the record, is disagreeing. Okay. Yes, Tom.
I know this is dragging on. I really strongly believe that if we're going to serve the users, that information we voted for, question four, has to be put in one place and put together, like in paragraph 8 of Appendix B, not just randomly.
So is there a specific recommendation in a future memo on that?
We didn't do that because it came out of like the Ed session. That's where we kind of threw.
Oh, okay,
that
I'm sorry,
together.
I wasn't at the Ed session.
We could. Would the illustration in the appendix? Or in the with an illustration and implementation guidance? No. Okay.
I think if we're going to serve the users, it's all got to be in one place. They can't be hunting and pecking to figure this out. If they're really wanting to be treating this as an operating expense, it's all that information has to be in one place.
But I think Pat made a good point about the potential for double counting as well.
That's why I would support Tom's recommendation, because you'd have to separate out the variable.
Yeah.
From the amortization, so that they didn't double count when they made that adjustment.
Okay.
I think what Pat's saying is that in order to, you've got to know what to add, take out and what to add, so you've got to know all the components of basically the expenses associated with leasing activities, which are what those four components are, and you need to have them in one place, and then the investor is going to need to understand where the company classified that in the income statement and the cash flow statement to be able to decide what they want to do with it. So I agree we should make that's a requirement that you've got to disclose them together.
You need a baseline.
Oh, okay. I guess we can require that they disclose it together, but it has to be accompanied by some discussion of how it relates to what's recognized on the balance sheet or not. Because you're combining dissimilar things here, I think. But
they're not going to do that. This is all an income statement adjustment.
I know.
Because what they've said is they'll just ignore the balance sheet. Because if it's an operating lease, it's not there. And what they want to do is to be able to come up with an adjustment to get to the expense.
Okay.
If you have all the expenses in different places, put them together, and then they'd swap out the first two line items for the cash flow information underneath it.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Do people support explicitly requiring that all of the expenses that are being recognized in the income statement in a period relating to leases be presented together in the footnotes? People, ISB, who supports adding that? That's a majority of the ISB. FASB, who would support adding that explicit requirement? Okay, you got a majority of the
Okay,
the
so based on that, the short-term expense numbers in that table, so you probably agree with that memo as well.
So can we skip that? No, we'll ask that later. Okay, I think that's it for now.
Can I just ask a question? In this chart, Nick, on the number 8, the variable leased expense is specifically excludes index.
Yeah, because that's in the liability, so it's in the amortization.
Okay.
And the cash payments accompany that. So that's how we'd say it. The table of all expenses together with the cash payments accompanying.
Okay. Okay, so we are now done with 187 and 190.
No, 188 and 190.
Oh, I'm sorry. And afterwards, we will talk about 187 and 189, time permitting.
189.
Okay, let's take a break. Can we come back at 20 after? And we'll